Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, how do you help people who need serious and immediate pain relief without creating more opioid addicts in America? We started thinking about that question when we heard this news.
For those fighting America's opioid epidemic, it's a hard pill to swallow. Politicians and drug safety advocates say the FDA's approval of Dysuvia, an opioid painkiller 10 times as potent as fentanyl, throws more fuel on the raging fires of America's opioid crisis.
And here's another question. What if we could inoculate some people against opioid addiction? Who would get the vaccine, given the fact that it likely wouldn't be 100% effective? Here's why this is so urgent. More Americans are dying from opioid overdoses every day, more than car accidents and guns. The CDC calls it a public health emergency. So two guests today, including a researcher who is working on an opioid vaccine at the University of Minnesota, and your experience with this. If you or someone in your family has dealt with an opioid addiction, have you found treatment or help that is effective? What works for you? What hasn't worked? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. And I'm on Twitter, as always, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Dr. Joseph Lee is in the studio with me, Medical Director of Youth Services at Hazelden Betty Ford and the author of Recovering My Kid. Always good to have you here. Dr. Lee, welcome. Good to have you here.
Great to be on your show again, Carrie.
Marco Pravitoni is with us. He's a senior research investigator at the U of M and the Hennepin Healthcare Research Institute, where he's working on a vaccine for opioid addiction. Marco, is that right about the U of M, or is this just at Hennepin Healthcare Research Institute?
Hi, Carrie, and it's great to be on the show. Our team is both at the University of Minnesota and the Hennepin Healthcare Research Institute downtown in Minneapolis.
Really a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much. Dr. Lee, I think first to understanding why the FDA would approve this even more powerful opioid called Dysuvia, 1,000 times more powerful than morphine. Is it targeted particularly at military injuries? And what do you think the consequences might be of this?
Well, I think I don't know exactly the thinking of the FDA, and the consequences could be multiple. You know, there may be a medical need for people who have acute injuries where other pain medications are insufficient, and so I'm sure that's where the research was leaning. But I think it's also good to have some skepticism about other opioids and how they've entered the black market and how they've affected people. And so I think caution is also warranted. What I'd say, though, as kind of a grain of wisdom is instead of canvassing a chemical as all good or all bad, we should understand that not all people are affected by the chemical the same way. So no matter how potent a chemical is, there are a number of people who won't misuse it. What we have to do is identify the high-risk individuals who might be more liable or susceptible to falling prey to some of the fallouts from it.
So is that something that you would be able to know if, let's say, you were in a military setting and the other drugs were not working and you were turning to something like Dysuvia? Would you have the information that you've just suggested would be important to have?
Yeah, actually, some hospital systems already do this. If you look at pain medication prescriptions and the kinds of people who may be more likely to develop an addiction or misuse them or divert them, some of the high-risk people have telltale signs. They might smoke cigarettes. They might use other substances. They might be prescribed benzodiazepines or other medications that can be habit-forming. So just looking at their prescription record, some elements of their profile can help screen some of the high-risk clients, and you might treat them on an individual basis that's a bit different. And I think that's a smarter approach than just canvassing a chemical as good or bad. But then again, I think the public's perception and concern about this chemical, given our opioid crisis, is warranted. We need to be cautious about how this is going to really enter the system in the marketplace.
You know, Dr. Pravatuni, I mean, this is the reason that we're talking about this, but in listening to Dr. Lee, it strikes me that we're kind of woefully undereducated about opioids, so that we do have a tendency, I think, to think of them as bad or good. How do you see that in the work kind of work that you're doing and the research you're doing?
Well, first of all, I agree with Dr. Lee's opinion and view, because we do need opioids. We do need potent analgesics and painkillers that can help people to overcome either acute or chronic pain in various situations that can range from just emergency situation to more the back pain type of situation. But as Dr. Lee was saying as well, we have to identify and carefully select the patients that would benefit from such treatments, so that we can avoid situations such as opioid misuse out of control and transitioning from just pain management to addiction. And so if we can screen patients, those that will benefit and what will be less likely to develop an addiction will actually help with this plan. So selection, or better, you know, as you suggested, educating the people that are prescribing these opioids will definitely help with a crisis and contain the population that may then misuse these formulations.
Here's Laura on Twitter, though. Dr. Lee, my oldest brother became addicted to opioids and completely hid it from our family for years until he came to us for help. He was able to rehab himself. He's healthy and happy today. Unfortunately, his story is more of an exception than a rule. I guess I would say, okay, so a situation like that where somebody, this is their first entry into the experience of using opioids for some kind of injury or something. How would you know what your tolerance is and what your background is?
Well, some people do have experiences like that, and I'm glad this person's relative is doing well. Some people, you know, they take a certain chemical, they're prescribed something for a wisdom teeth removal or a back operation, and they get hooked on it. It opens a door for them. It gives them a kind of euphoria or a kind of feeling that they haven't experienced before.
And the reason for this, just interrupt for a moment, is because our brain chemistry is individual and there's no kind of standard of how people will react to this. Is that right?
That's right. There's incredible variation. The mechanism of addiction is very Pavlovian. So it's like Pavlov's dog, where you kind of give the dog food and you ring the bell. And then after a while, you ring the bell and don't give the dog food and the dog still salivates. So what actually happens is not all people are conditioned by reward as powerfully as others. And there's a great deal of variability. And so some people, when they get rewarded heavily, form conditioning. They form a memory about it and they turn to anticipate and get triggered by it. And this is the kind of mechanism that is behind the opioid epidemic, behind alcoholism, behind the vaping of Juuls and e-cigarettes. This is behind so much of it. It's a very primitive part of our biology that gets taken advantage of by certain contexts.
That's one of the best descriptions of why some people get addicted and others don't that I've heard. So thank you for that. Let me go to the calls here to Tom in Minneapolis. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What's your experience with this?
Well, I was addicted to opioid painkillers for several years, 2 or 3 years, and I did not want to go into a treatment center because I didn't want to lose my job and I didn't want my family to find out. So I actually went online, and there is in the state of Minnesota right now, there's quite a few doctors right now that are offering treatment. And one of the treatment options that I was given is a drug called Suboxone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been on that for, I'd say about 2 years now. It's a maintenance drug for people that are addicted to opioid painkillers or heroin.
Is it working for you, Tom?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
It takes away my cravings. When I first started taking opioids, I experienced the euphoria you were talking about, and it's... let me tell you, it's a great feeling. I mean, I can understand how people easily get addicted to these painkillers because it gives you a false sense of well-being.
Yeah.
I can... And but it took me a long time. I mean, I lost so much weight. My face was all sunken in because I didn't want to eat. Because when you eat, when you're on opioid painkillers and you eat, that takes the high away.
Tom, but you've raised something that I didn't want to miss in the conversation, because we've just talked about how opioids affect people differently. We're going to talk about how this vaccine might affect people differently. What about Suboxone, Dr. Lee?
I think
I'm asking Dr. Lee about that.
I think Suboxone is a great option. You know, there's Suboxone, methadone, injectable naltrexone are the main medications that we use. In fact, many of the people with severe opioid addiction, we tell them that, you know, it's probably better off if you take a medication rather than not. That's what the evidence and the research says. And they can find recovery through it. So I really want to congratulate Tom on his journey and his courage for sharing part of that story. Buprenorphine, the Suboxone medication he's talking about, is an opioid agonist antagonist in a non-nerdy way, explaining that. It's kind of like it's a blocker, but it also activates the receptor at the same time. So it's almost like if you step on the gas pedal of your car, but there's a brick behind it, so you can only push so far. So it can block other opioids from getting into your brain and activating your brain, but it also satisfies cravings. And I think it's a great health option for them. The only unfortunate part of Tom's story is that I think we need to be in a time where the stigma is lessened. Mm. And I think that's just so sad, because I hear this all the time, that because of a fear of some repercussion, people are not getting adequate treatment. I'm glad Tom was able to find it.
Dr. Pravatoni, I want to ask you now about the vaccine and whether you are looking at the same situation. It will be effective for some people. It will not be effective for others. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. As Tom's story and also Dr. Lee's point, treatments, they, just like opioid abuse or misuse, they're affected by individual variability. So each individual may benefit from, let's say, methadone versus Suboxone versus, let's say, a vaccine. So like any other medication, we are developing a vaccine with the intent of adding one more tool that physicians and patients can benefit from. And obviously, as any other medication or treatment, will be important to understand what's the best population for the vaccine, who will be the best individual benefiting from the vaccine. And so to get at that, like other groups have done for obviously methadone and so forth, we are developing this vaccine pipeline, but also we are trying to define biomarkers that potentially can identify those subjects, those patients that will actually benefit from the vaccine.
Yeah, Dr. Pravatoni, does it work, though, as I guess we lay people basically understand vaccines, which is that you activate antibodies against the substance. Is that what your vaccine would do, too?
Yeah, that's correct. Pretty much like any other vaccine. So we're vaccinated against several infectious diseases, so things like tetanus and diphtheria and so forth. The vaccine that we are developing will trigger the patient immune system so that each individual will develop their own endogenous antibodies, and these antibodies will be very selective for the target drug. And so once the person is ingesting, snorting, or injecting opioids, the mm-hmm. antibodies will bind the opioid and prevent its crossing to the brain.
Okay.
So that essentially it works pretty much like a sponge, if you will, like to prevent the effects of these opioids.
Interesting. Soaking up the opioid before it gets to the receptors. Is that
That's
right?
Correct.
Huh. Yeah.
That's correct.
A call here from Al in Eden Prairie. Hi, Al.
Hi there. Great conversation. I can kind of relate to what you were talking about with different people and different receptiveness to this type of thing. I've had surgery a couple, three times over the last 10 to 15 years, and every time I've been in there, I know that the awareness has become more and more apparently about these problems, because the last time I had surgery about 2 years ago, they started out with, I don't know, I think it was Tylenol 3, and then I think it did absolutely nothing. I explained to them the fact that when I had my knee surgeries years ago, they had to ramp it up quickly because nothing seemed, you know, they went to Dilaudid, and I think they went to finally, I remember what the last one was, I think it was oxycodone, I believe it was.
But your point is?
It definitely affects people differently. It took what would be probably seem like a lot of medication to have an effect on me because of my metabolism, the doctor said. But other people probably, you know, might have had a problem or solution with much less or a lower level drug. But it's just the way my physiology works, where I need, and it wasn't like it made a huge difference. It wasn't like a person like this said they felt high or something like that.
Right.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
It just numbed it a little bit. They finally had to give me the same thing, the IV, and that's what it finally. Okay, now it's effective.
So you've raised something that we were talking about earlier that I wanted to pursue here. Dr. Lee, if you haven't been on these kinds of medications, how do you know what your tolerance is? And is your health provider keeping, I mean, are we finding in some cases that your health provider is not keeping close enough track of how you're being affected by the opioid? Is that part of the problem here?
I definitely think the way the healthcare system is structured, and it's not all the healthcare provider's fault. They work in a system where they have to see lots of patients an hour, and there are other burdens, but I don't think the system is sophisticated enough to really individualize pain management for people. And instead, we look at drugs as good or bad. So what you've seen is a downside to some of our concern about opioids. There are people in the country with genuine pain. And what we do is instead of focusing on people, we focus on the drugs. And so then we're going to prescribe liberally and we cause the opioid epidemic. Now we're tightening down on the prescription. So if anybody wants a prescription more than 4 days, we give them the stink eye. And that's not the right method. And so there are some individuals who don't have a family history of addiction. They've never misused substances. So when they get activated and powerfully conditioned by opioids, they're taken by surprise. And I'm not sure if we can screen for those people right away. But there are other people who may have had forays into misusing various substances, who may smoke nicotine products, who may have had struggles in their family with addiction, and they might be at higher risk. And so there are ways to kind of do some risk stratification and individual tailoring of pain management and even preoperative procedures to get better results for people instead of making people feel blamed.
I want to ask you about something that I was reading and preparing for the show about overprescription versus the black market. There is some research that has come out to say, even though a lot of medical professionals are taking this on, it was our fault, we were overprescribing, that the people who are actually getting addicted to opioids are people with heroin habits or drug habits, and that the blame doesn't fall as squarely on the medical community as we think it does. Fair enough or no?
I think that's very fair. I think in our country, when there's any kind of social issue, we like to see the smoking gun. We like to make the discussion a binary. Who's good? Who's bad? Who's at fault? The opioid crisis is very complicated. In fact, the black market has evolved because of the dark web and these clandestine labs in China and different places sending fentanyl over. We were making a bit of a dent in the opioid epidemic, and then fentanyl came in. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid, incredibly powerful. You only need a little bit to get very high, and so it can be very dangerous for people. Fentanyl's been cut into everything, including heroin, what looks like oxycodone and other pain medications. People are pressing pills. I know this because I see kids who deal drugs or use across the country, and I've seen it happen over the years.
Coming into your practice.
That's right. Yeah. And now fentanyl is getting a lot of the blame for continued or increased number of deaths from opioids. And this is another area where I think vaccines are going to be fascinating as a tool in helping people stay alive.
Dr. Pravatoni, on fentanyl, please, before we go back to the phones.
Yeah, so as both of you were saying, essentially fentanyl is particularly at risk because most of the overdose deaths in the United States and Minnesota have been associated with fentanyl. And as Dr. Lee was saying, not always fentanyl is prescribed to you, but you may be taken by surprise. So, for example, even cocaine users, for instance, may encounter fentanyl in their regular supply chain. And so those are not opioid users, so they have no tolerance toward fentanyl. And that's how, like, some of the accidental deaths happen. And on the fentanyl, I think the vaccine will have, particularly since fentanyl is very potent, and so being potent means that abuse or misuse doses are not very high, so will be much easier, so to speak, for vaccines and for antibody-based therapy to prevent fentanyl-induced effects such as respiratory depression, because you don't need to block much of the fentanyl compared to something like heroin, for instance, where people tend to have very high doses, which are much more difficult to counteract.
Dr. Marco Pravitoni with us. If you've just tuned in, he's an associate professor at the U of M and a senior investigator at the Hennepin Healthcare Research Institute. And you may have read about the work he's doing on a vaccine for opioid addiction, hearing some of the dimensions of that conversation this morning. It wouldn't work for everybody. It's still in development. It's not on the market yet, but understanding a bit of the work that Dr. Pravitoni is doing on that. And Dr. Joseph Lee with us, medical director at Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation at Youth Services. And asking you this morning, as you hear us push this conversation on opioid addiction and understand what's happening with it now, if you or someone in your family has dealt with this, have you found a treatment or the help that has been effective? What have you found works? What doesn't? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, wherever you are in the region, and on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. A call here from Kaven in Bloomington. Hi, good morning.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing well. I'm glad you called. It sounds like you've had a personal family experience with this.
Yeah, definitely. I lost my wife to fentanyl toxicity in September of 2017.
Oh, my gosh. I am really sorry for your loss. What is it, something where she was taking opioids and then got into a drug habit or what?
Exactly. She was first prescribed Vicodin and then Percocet. And then when that wasn't strong enough, it was heroin because it was a lot cheaper than buying pills on the street, like a third of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
So she was snorting heroin, and I was too. And I went to work one day and came home, and she was gone. She was on the bed, just passed away. After she passed away, I went to treatment a few months later. In April, I went to Hazelden, actually.
Uh-huh.
And so as far as treatment goes, I'm wishing that there's something more effective than that, because the vast majority of people that go to treatment, they get out, they may be clean for a month or two, but I've read about some statistics saying that 85% of people end up relapsing that go to inpatient therapy. So I actually was in therapy in 2009 as well, and I relapsed 2 weeks after I got out.
You are asking a really important question, and we've got just the guy to answer it. So I'm really glad you've called. Dr. Lee?
Yeah, I first want to give condolences. Thank you so much for sharing your story, and I'm so sorry for your loss. And I also kind of hear your passion for wanting to honor your wife's memory and wanting to find help. I think statistics are mixed. We have our own statistics. I think it's a little better than people.
Hazelden's.
Right.
Yes.
And I think the modality now needs to really be about meeting people where they're at and really telling people that if you have an opioid addiction, the science says taking a medication like buprenorphine is going to be better for you. But not all people are going to choose that. I have a lot of young people where taking any kind of medication is a real threat on their sense of agency, who they are, what they control.
Wow.
So there are some, you know, battle lines drawn with young people even when you offer them medications. But having multiple modalities, different ways of treating people, meeting them where they're at, I think helps the most. I would say there can be a back and forth with a chronic illness, but that doesn't mean that people don't find recovery in the end. In much the same way that people with diabetes can have elevated blood sugars despite insulin regimens and whatnot. And so instead of looking at everything as a treatment success or a failure, we tend to look at things as an empathic journey where we want people to connect with people. And so I think vaccines are awesome. We consider people like Dr. Pravitoni partners in a collective mission that we have to save lives. But the spirit of healing is more than just getting off of drugs. It is really finding healing through connection and fellowship. And so that's the kind of message that we want to spread to other people.
You said something important there about this idea that a relapse is a failure, and that we have a tendency to look at this as, well, that didn't work, on to the next thing. You've begun thinking of this, which I know probably isn't good news for families that have a loved one who is dealing with this, but it's more of a setback and a returning to treatment than I went to rehab, it worked or it didn't, now what do I do?
That's right. And people know themselves the best, and people are in the end going to choose. They're the ones that are in control about the kind of treatments they're going to want. And so understanding that, respecting that, honoring that, you try to meet them where they're at, and you find that a lot of people will find treatment in different ways, mm-hmm. whether it's outpatient medications. Some people feel like their environment, a lot of young people have environments that are hard to escape, so sometimes they need residential care. But there are different ways to go about it, and I think the spirit of inclusiveness and empathy is really important. The other part that the audience, I think, doesn't understand is even with evidence-based care doesn't mean 100% effective. I don't think enough people explain that. It means that it can be validated, reproduced, but it doesn't mean that it's 100% effective. And so methadone, Suboxone, the research on it is that it's better than not taking it. It does not mean that it's foolproof by any measure. It is still a very difficult condition to treat because of that pathologic conditioning we talked about, that behavioral conditioning, the craving, the hunger for it, the behaviors that are set in motion, the chaos that comes. And so a lot of people that do well not only stop using substances or find their own way through the substance of their choice, but they also find a community, a spiritual kind of healing as well. Mm-hmm. And that's when people find recovery. That's what we call recovery. People not just get off drugs, but they work on the risk factors that got them in trouble in the first place.
I got a tweet here from somebody who was saying Narcotics Anonymous was essential. So that worked for somebody, right? Doesn't always work for everybody.
That's right. And let me just give an empathic take to this and why the discussion might be a bit polarized. If you have a life-threatening condition and you found your way and got saved a certain way, you're going to swear by that method.
That's right.
You know, if you had a really bad health condition and you had to have this diet plan, whether it was the paleo diet or whatever else, and you lost a lot of weight and your life was saved, you're going to swear by that, and that's going to be the thing that you're going to want to prescribe to everybody. And that's just your experience, you see. And so what we have to do is collect these people, have them understand that not everything fits everybody, but we've seen a group of people do well here. And if you self-select for that and if you want that, you're probably going to do well. And so you see people that like Narcotics Anonymous who do well in Narcotics Anonymous, mm-hmm. and the same thing with Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I think there can be multiple pathways for people to get well, and we can have people self-select and choose for what they think is right for them.
Dr. Pravatoni, what's the next step in the vaccine development?
Well, in the vaccine development area, the next step is to keep plugging along. We have started this work in 2008, and then through the years, we have developed the concept and have done the research, and now we are currently manufacturing these vaccines so that we can make sufficient material under pharmaceutical industry guidelines so that we can get ready for a clinical trial. So all I can say is that essentially we keep pushing forward, keep doing the research and generating more evidence that this is an effective and safe approach. And the other approach that we've been taking is that, as pretty much this conversation suggested from all the points, even from the callers, individual variability is key here. And so, for instance, when we start this work, we are working primarily with heroin and oxycodone. And then as the opioid epidemics develop and become more of a complex scenario, we are expanding our pipeline to other targets to include more recently fentanyl and possibly fentanyl analogs. So this is, we keep expanding and trying to sort of not really foresee, but get along with what's the epidemiology so that we can possibly help more people or more, people subset so that we can really get at that population specificity that suffer from different type of opioids.
I appreciate you letting us take you away from the work for a bit and for being part of the show. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Marco Pravatoni, senior investigator at the Hennepin Healthcare Research Institute. If you're getting in late, he is working on a vaccine for opioid addiction. Dr. Joseph Lee continues with us, medical director at Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation Youth Continuum. Your calls and questions about what works and what you're taking away from this discussion I think this is interesting. I don't know that we've ever gotten into this before with Dr. Lee, but this idea that relapse doesn't equal failure, that there is a multidimensional approach to what will work for some people won't work for others. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that and maybe how your experience informs the way you're listening to this. Back to the discussion now. I want to let you know if you're getting in into the middle of this, you can always find this show and all of our others on the podcast. To the phones here to Patricia in Minneapolis. Hi, Patricia. Thank you so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
Sure. Thank you for having me. My experience is I'm about 60 years old, and when I was a teenager, my father went through treatment. He was a relapsing, remitting alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And 10 years later, my youngest brother was addicted and went through Hazelden, a program for young people. And he's been in recovery for 36 years, so I'm very grateful
for
that.
That's good news.
And the program, yeah. Hazelden had a 6-month for my brothers and my mother and I. Mm-hmm. And then I unfortunately or fortunately married a remitting, relapsing alcoholic. And he's my former spouse, but he's been in recovery for about 15 years now. And I would just like to say, I also lost a nephew 10 years ago. He was 28 and became addicted to painkillers from an injury when he was doing landscape work at college.
Uh-huh.
And he finished college, but by the time he was 28, he'd been through treatment 3 times. And I don't believe that the 30-day model that was kind of made famous in Minnesota in the 70s is effective for opioid addiction. And I really found Dr. Lee's insights very, very helpful in understanding how different treatment works for different addictions, different people, that heroin is a much different addiction to treat than alcoholism. And I believe the opioid addiction and crisis the country's experiencing now needs a different model than a 30-day model, because it's not going to work for most
people. It's a really, really good question. Dr. Lee?
Yeah, I think it's people say the 30-day model because I think that was the tradition back in the day. But, you know, our working with insurance companies and families as, you know, we have some people that stay in treatment 14 days. We have some people who only do outpatient. You know, we have everything from parent coaching and family services to online apps, medication prescribing like buprenorphine in the outpatient setting. So I think we really have a continuum. And I don't like the word rehab anymore because that speaks to a kind of traditionalism that I don't really choose to defend because that's not what I do. On the ground, seeing people and families, and I want to thank the caller for sharing the joys and tragedies of her life and the heartaches and the blessings. And I don't get stuck too much in the theory of this philosophy versus that because I'm just trying to show compassion and accurate empathy for the people I'm seeing in front of me. And so I want to demystify, regardless of whether you go to residential, however many days you do things, there are medications that if you have an opioid addiction that can keep you alive. They can prevent you from overdosing. Some of them can help with cravings, and you should definitely, I strongly urge you to consider that if you have an opioid use disorder. And you should also have Narcan around just in case there's a risk of overdosing. And so that's the medical part of it. But in the healing part of it, I want to demystify it a little bit because it's not telling people not to use drugs. I'm not teaching kids about brain chemistry and all the harms of drugs. What I'm really doing in therapy sessions when I meet with young people who are addicted to opioids or other things is I'm appealing to their goodness and their values. So for example, they have a conditioning where they want to use substances and they get into a lot of trouble from it. But they also love their family and they also want a future for themselves. And that's a conflict that's not with me. It's a conflict that they have inside. And what I do is I serve as a guide, I listen to them, and I bring that side of them out that is more consistent and aligned with their values. And what you see is a change where these people then start to not only go towards their values, wanting relationships, wanting sobriety, but they also feel affirmed. So they start to feel capable as people. They start to feel that they are good people and deserving of a better life. And so I know a lot of this treatment dialogue sounds so kind of externally driven that you're in some place and you get these medications, but that's not where I think the healing takes place. And so I want to kind of offer that moment of sanctity about what recovery is really about. It's not this kind of dialogue. And I think, again, what the caller is emphasizing also is how important families are to treatment. this is a systems disease, not just an individual disease. And so we try our best to engage family systems because they suffer as well and they heal together.
You know, you took me aback a bit when you started that by saying I appeal to their goodness and their values, because there was a time in America where we believed that good people didn't have addictions. I know that's not what you're saying, but and I don't want it to be misinterpreted. So when you say that you appeal to their values, what you're saying, their desires, their optimism for their lives, their goals, what? What are we really talking about here?
It's not a moral code.
I mean, that's kind of how it sounded,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, and I think that's how it sounded with goodness. I think I'm using a language of motivational interviewing. It's a kind of therapy that I've been trained in. And so what I mean by goodness is the capacity for them to become the people that they want to be.
Okay.
And people have individual values, but there are some common values people share, and it comes from an empathic perspective. And so what I do is I have other people maybe listen to the advice that they might give other people. And that serves as their values. And so it's not a religious or moral kind of good or bad. Like, so for example, some people are really upset that family members are upset with them, but they want to continue substances and they don't want to do outpatient therapy anymore. Mm-hmm. And so what I say is, hey, it's your life. It's your choice. But if somebody were sitting in this room and they had your life exactly and your circumstances, what kind of advice would you give them? And I promise you, like 90% of them look at me and they smile just like you're smiling at me now. And they say, I tell them to stay in therapy.
Because the answer is so obvious.
That's right. And that's not something I downloaded in
them. Right.
And then what I say to them after that is, it's still your choice to leave therapy if you want. But I think you just heard your own values. And then they have a choice to make. And those are the areas where healing happens. I don't know if that's communicated well in the public with all the newspaper stories and all the tragedies we've had. But there's a lot of hope. There are millions of people in recovery who found that kind of goodness in the same way. And it's not a moral, religious thing. It's something that they feel good about.
That's why I love having you on the show. New things to understand. To John in Fergus Falls. Hi, John. Thanks for waiting.
Hi there. Thanks. I just wanted to add a couple comments to the conversation. I am an addict alcoholic. Mm-hmm. My 22nd birthday was a couple weeks ago.
Congratulations.
Not my belly button birthday, but my recovery birthday.
Right.
The opioid crisis is a huge, complicated thing. But I think we need to keep it in perspective as far as, it's sad that so many people are dying, but alcohol kills more people than all the other drugs combined.
So, John, I forgive me here for kind of pushing you along a little bit here,
because we
have so many other people that want to speak.
Okay.
Are you calling to say you're worried that opioids are being demonized and they help people? And so we want to be careful not to do that.
Well, yes, they saved my life because I have a pump inside my abdomen.
Uh-huh.
I'm in chronic pain for the last 30 years.
Uh-huh.
And without opioids, I don't think I'd be around.
I think you're saying something that Dr. Lee wants to make sure is heard in the conversation. Dr. Lee, yes?
Yeah, I think so. And I think he's highlighting exactly what we've been talking about and setting up, that there's a lot of variability. And people get well in different ways, and people have different ideas and different reactions to different medications and different thoughts on it. And I think a rich discussion is welcome. I think that people who decades ago had to fight against stigma so that we could have a platform to talk about addiction like this, I think they would welcome the richness of the discussion and the people's experiences today. And so I think it's just more to say that there's science that shows us a guide, and within that science, there can be a framework for individual care. And so we know from the evidence, especially when you're working with young people, people do better on medications if they have severe opioid use disorder. And people also do better when families are involved.
I wanted to get to this, too, about this idea of the squeamishness about getting pain medication. Because I had a friend of a friend who was saying very proudly that she had not used pain medication after having some kind of surgery. And I thought, okay, so you went through 48 hours of feeling really uncomfortable because we've kind of instilled this fear about taking any kind of heavy-duty pain relief. How do we get the balance right?
Well, sometimes the balance is hard for individuals, and people will draw lines in the sand in their own minds about what they want to do, and I think we have to respect that. But let me just say that there have been people who have been in recovery for a long time who happen to need a major surgery, and we tell them to take pain medications because they will be in pain.
Yeah.
But they take it for a short duration, and then they get off of it, and they're fine. And they might need some extra support around that time. And so I just want to get away from this black and white thinking about substances, focus more on people, all the good that we could do if we could just individualize care, understand the variability of people, and focus on people instead of drugs. We'd invest more in prevention.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have a lot less stigma. We'd have better treatments. And there wouldn't be so much polarization in the dialogue about how people get well.
As you know, I'm about to leave here and go to the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation event, where Susan Ford will be, and somebody who wrote a book about Betty Ford. And when Betty Ford came out to talk about pain medication addiction and alcoholism, it was like an earthquake in this country, that somebody who'd been admired and revered would come out and confess something like this. So here's my question for you. Have our views about addiction really changed all that much? Yes, we might talk about it more openly, but have our kind of core views about what addiction really means changed all that much?
I think your producer, Kate Moos, said this well. I think there's something in every generation, no matter how much we educate people, there's a sense of agency with addiction that's troubling to people.
Mm-hmm.
What are they responsible for? A lot of ugliness happens in addiction. There's a lot of moral attribution that occurs in addiction. Who's responsible for what? Who's in control? And I think that drives some of the stigma. And we have to correct that kind of dialogue. We have to just say, look, people have variability. Some people get conditioned very powerfully. It doesn't matter how smart you are. It doesn't matter how spiritual you are. It doesn't matter how great a character you have or what you've done in life. Addiction can be an equal opportunity offender, but there's hope for you if you get the right services. And there's millions of people who have gone through your journey and who have kind of paved the way and can serve as examples for your recovery.
Let me go to Mary in Minneapolis. Hey, Mary, thanks for calling. What'd you want to say?
Hi. Hi. Thanks for having me on the air. I just wanted to touch again on the doctor's point about really highlighting and focusing in on people's values and giving them hope for the future.
Sure.
My brother passed away from an opioid overdose, and in the conversation that we had with him, it was the shame and the guilt is what triggered his use. He would say, I don't have a drug problem, I have a drug solution, because he was trying to fix brokenness within himself. And when he was clean and sober, it was when he could really focus on, you know, I can contribute to society. I can have a future. I have goodness in me. I don't have to be a burden and a problem for other people. And so I think transforming rehab in that way and addiction and giving people hope and value that they know is inside of them, but really bringing that out and emphasizing that to them was just a game changer for my brother. And I just appreciate that the doctor brought up that point.
Good.
And highlighted that.
Good. And I'm sorry that your brother passed away. It sounds like whatever kind of treatment he was going through, Mary, it was just difficult for him to get on the other side of this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was a lifelong battle. I think, you know, in his passing, I think I'm a person of faith, and so I know he's in a better place, and I know that was, you know, the solution for him. But I think when he was on earth here, just highlighting that goodness that we all have inside of us and really, like I said, bringing it out was instrumental in keeping him sober for when he was sober.
I appreciate the call. Thanks for sharing that. Dr. Lee, did you want to say something else?
Yeah, I just want to thank you for sharing again. Very important information. And you know, I'm getting the sense from kind of a meta perspective that, you know, if we talked about addiction this way, about people and values and the things that are important to them and family members and loss and joy, I think stigma would be reduced. Because to your point earlier, there's still a lot of stigma. It affects everything from infrastructure to payment to policy. And so we still have to do a better job of educating. And the more people that come out of the woodwork and are sharing and share in the spirit that the caller just did, in a spirit of healing and wanting to connect with people, If we do that, I think we can change how people perceive addiction. It's not a bunch of procedures and medications and treatment and so many days only. There's a person-centered part of the disease that is probably most important, a family community part of the illness that is most concerning. And I think if we start there, I think we'll get our priorities straight.
I noticed that you said among the things that stigma affects is payment. Are you saying the insurance industry holds a stigma about addiction recovery and thus does not reimburse at the level that it might?
I don't think there's just one, you know, baddie here. It's not so binary, but cumulatively, even within medical education, there's a stigma for mental health and addiction. It's well and alive. It's better, but it's still there. And I've said this, I think, before on air, but you know, you have families who have addiction issues or mental health issues. They go to a beautiful hospital. They walk into the atrium. It's a new hospital with new facilities, and they are seeking addiction services, and they're sent to the back annex or a clinic that's down the road. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that is other than stigma, you know, because what is it that they have a second-class illness and they're second-class citizens? And if people saw how many people are yearning, how many families are yearning for recovery and a way out, and if people could see that there is hope and science behind it to get people well, I think we could reduce some of that and change the infrastructure. And so payment is a part of it. I think stigma goes way beyond people being ashamed of talking about their use.
Call here from Sandra in Burnsville. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, thank you.
Of course.
My son became addicted to prescription medications. And he started forging his prescriptions, not forging, but altering. Mm-hmm. And he got caught and ran into some legal problems, went to treatment, and started on Suboxone. And he's off the opiates. However, he can't get off the Suboxone.
Ah.
And he tried one time and ended up stealing some Klonopin that I had in my, in my bathroom.
Your question, Sandra, to Dr. Lee is mm-hmm. what?
Well, how are people able to get off Suboxone? What are the alternatives?
All right. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks.
You know, the science is says that people who get off of Suboxone for opioid addiction, they're in some trouble. They tend to relapse more and go back to using substances. And so there's individual variation. People may want to get off of Suboxone. And we've had people who just for their own autonomy don't want to take any medication, and that's their right. And so we try to strategize as much as possible. But for some people, that's difficult. And a lot of people would just tell them, you know, don't worry about the Suboxone right now. That's the last thing you should be worrying about. Just continue to take the Suboxone. It's keeping you alive and satisfying cravings. You can still find recovery through it. Just work on the other things you've told me about, you know. And so I'm not saying that this is advice directly for the caller, but Suboxone can cause withdrawal if you try to stop taking it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think maybe people make too much of a fuss of trying to get off of it unnecessarily. And I think that's more of a reflection of their autonomy and wanting to control their lives and not necessarily good, sound medical advice.
Good question here on Twitter from Megan, who says, these drugs should be available and accessible to people who need them, but it seems that pain has become a vital sign, as important as a pulse. How do we get back to acceptable levels of pain being tolerated by doctors and patients alike? We could probably do a whole hour on that, but if you'll speak to it now.
Well, there's a lot in pain and that it's hard to measure. When I was in medical school, definitely pain was a vital sign and pain was undertreated, and that started some of the problem with the opioid epidemic. I think the pendulum in some ways is swinging the other way, where we're starting to blame patients again.
Mm.
And people have different encampments about pain. Some people still think it's undertreated, but a lot of people are overreacting. And again, I think if we understand that people experience pain very differently too. So just because you have a crush injury doesn't mean that you're going to experience pain the same as somebody else, a person with mental health issues, people who may seek different medications, people who want to tough it out on their own. They all have a different experience of pain than other people. You know, there's a famous quote that I'm probably going to butcher, but it's, you know, pain, you know, with acceptance is pain. Pain without acceptance is suffering. And I think that's from dialectical behavioral therapy. And I think that we kind of need to get to that human place when we're talking about pain. And that will allow us to individualize care. I've treated many patients with intense pain, people who've had their esophagus ripped out because of cancer, they've had to have surgery, people who have intense lymphedema, incredible pain that I couldn't imagine. And these individuals, I couldn't find a direct solution for the pain, but over time, they learned to cope with it in their own way. That was incredibly admirable. And so there are many venues to pain. It's not as simple as pain medications or no pain medications. We have to stop the binary dialogue and start talking about people.
We have less than a minute here, but I was going to say, I'm sympathetic with medical professionals who are trying to figure this out, right? It's really hard to get inside the experience of the patient.
Yes.
For the very reasons that you've just described.
That's right. And that's why empathy is a skill, because when you're crunched for time and you're seeing somebody in a medical clinic, sometimes you feel like you're in a no-win situation. But if you learn how to have accurate empathy and listen to patients and what they need, you can find that balance and you can find solutions for a lot of people. It's not a quick fix thing, though, you know, but there's a lot of hope down the road.
Dr. Lee, thanks so much for the hour. As always, good to have you in the studio.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.